Now, let's take a look back at the year in sports. Local fans celebrated Tom Brady's return from his Deflategate suspension and the career of David Ortiz. The Chicago Cubs won the World Series, and there was plenty to cheer at the Rio Olympics, including dominant performances by American women. Back home in the U.S., sports got entangled in the culture wars. We also said goodbye to some legendary sports figures, including Pat Summitt and Muhammad Ali. Boston Globe sports columnist Dan Shaughnessy joins us now in studio as we remembered what happened on and off the field. Dan, welcome. Good to see you.
Nice to be here, Shira. How are you?
Good. Let's start with the Patriots. Here's what Brady said when he returned from his four-game Deflategate suspension.
I thought the team, you know, the team played really well. So it was fun to be a part of it. And it's been a fun week to get ready to play and kind of be back doing, you know, what I love to do.
Dan, how surprised were you that Brady accepted his suspension?
Yeah, we had a notion
surprised.
This might be going to the Supreme Court, and they could have kept fighting it. I think it became clear when the Court of Appeals came up tails on that, and they were pretty decisive with their ruling. And I think the uncertainty of going into the season, not knowing if he might have to serve later on in the season, I think it was they were better served to have him serve out of the jump, knowing he would not be there for the first four games. And it's worked out magically for him. They went 3-1 without Tom Brady, and now they're in position to go back to the Super Bowl now that he's here.
I want to go back to the current season, but first, were you a little disappointed that it didn't get to the Supreme Court? I think that would have been quite a spectacle to see Brady and maybe Gisele Bündchen parading into the Supreme Court with all those lawyers that they had at hand.
Spectacle's the word. This thing was carried out over 18 months and a lot of nonsense, a lot of dollars spent, a lot of words spilled. It was great for talk radio. It was great for commentary. We all enjoyed that. The Patriots ultimately paid the price of their intransigence and their reluctance to be forthcoming on a very small infraction.
You mentioned how well it worked out, even with Brady accepting the suspension and missing the first four games. How surprised were you by the performance of backup QB Jimmy Garoppolo and the fact that they're now, you know, they have the best record in the AFC, and they appear headed to another Super Bowl?
They're well coached. They're a veteran team. They've been there every year. This will be six straight AFC championship games for them. So they were going to carry on pretty well with or without Tom Brady over those games. It worked out about like we thought. 3-1, 3 out of 4 is good. And, of course, they've only lost one game since he has come back. But I was not surprised to see him win 3 out of 4 without Tom. And I think that with Tom, the sky's the limit. They can actually win the Super Bowl again this year.
What do you think the odds are on them doing exactly that?
I think they're going to get there. I don't see anybody in the AFC stopping them. They're in good position. They should be home throughout the playoffs. Pittsburgh coming here could be a threat to them. And then in the ultimate game, you look at the Dallas Cowboys, perhaps, maybe Seattle Seahawks, outside chance the Giants, which, of course, would have everybody here hiding under the covers if they had to play the Giants again in the Super Bowl.
We all know why. So let's turn to the Red Sox. They reached the postseason, but for many fans, the big story was David Ortiz's retirement. What's your favorite memory of Ortiz? Was it a walk-off hit, a conversation you had with him?
It was a really amazing 15 years that David was here. He was not a big deal when they got him. He was platooning with Jeremy Giambi. It was 2003. Wasn't playing a lot in April and May that year. Inserted himself, started to get the big hits. And then, of course, 2004, they win the World Series. He had a tremendous amount of big hits. For me, the greatest, I mean, people are going to remember the marathon moment when he stood up and spoke for the city and used the F-bomb, which was okayed by the FCC in that instance. I think that on the field, his home run against the Tigers in 2013, which was the marathon year in the aftermath, and that turned around a series. They were probably going to lose that series. They're down 5-1 in the eighth inning, hits a grand slam, and then goes on to hit .688 in the World Series. That was the best of David Ortiz on the field, I thought.
You mentioned David Ortiz's words after the Boston Marathon bombing. It was when fans filled Fenway Park for one of the first big gatherings since the attack. And he, I think, put out one of his most famous speeches, had some of his most famous words then, and we can take a listen to that.
This is our city. And nobody gonna dictate our freedom. Stay strong. Thank you.
Red Sox historian Gordon Eads spoke with Radio Boston in October about how Ortiz connected with the fans in a different way, another side of him.
I mean, the man may have set a big league record for the number of hugs he gave. It's truly, I've never seen opposing players line up in conga lines just to greet David during batting practice on a nightly basis.
Talk about the void he leaves with the Red Sox and how the team will fill it, both in terms of his offensive performance, but also in terms of his personality.
He really became the face of the franchise, really the face of baseball, Father Christmas of baseball, the ongoing farewell tour, the All-Star game, what have you. The commissioner of baseball came here the last day of the season and basically gave him a presidential pardon for his perhaps drug infraction from 2003. So he got a lot of love, and locally, and the Red Sox took out a full-page ad in the Boston Globe saying he was it was parsed out carefully, but like the most important player in franchise history, stands alone, which might make you wonder where Ted Williams stands. But in any event,
yes,
obviously a big deal. They win three championships with him. And there's the off-the-field component, which Gordon just addressed, all the hugs and so well-loved. He was great to fans. He was great to the media. He was great to his teammates. So it's a lot to replace. On the field, it's 35 home runs, 120 RBIs. It's a lot to replace. They score a lot of runs. They have good pitching. I think they can absorb that loss with the people they have. They won't be as potent a lineup, but it's enough to get them where they need to go.
All right, let's go west. The Red Sox didn't win the World Series, but the Cubs did, breaking a 108-year drought. And they did it with the help of one Theo Epstein. As we know, he left the Red Sox to lead the Cubs. Here he is just after the Cubs' big win.
So happy for Cub fans over the last 108 years, mm-hmm. generations. Some still here, some not. They're all here tonight, and everyone who's ever put on a Cub uniform, this is for you guys, too.
So he helped Boston end its drought. Now Chicago, where does he go next?
Well, it's interesting. Of course, he was raised about a half mile from the studio we're sitting in. This is his neighborhood we're sitting in. And Theo comes to the Red Sox as a 28-year-old GM, the youngest in the history of baseball at that time. And he's now 42. He has been the point person to wipe out the two greatest longstanding curses in baseball history, the curse of the Bambino here in Boston, which was 86 years, 108 years in Chicago. That puts him in the Hall of Fame, but that's a ways off because you don't go into the Hall of Fame until you're in your 70s or you're 5 years retired. He's not close to either one of those. There might be a time when he's done with baseball and he goes into another arena, perhaps the political arena. He's a very smart guy. He's a thoughtful guy. I'd love to write his book, but he's too smart. He'll write his own book, and there's a lot to say.
So seriously, though, how much credit does Theo Epstein deserve or should go to Epstein for the Cubs winning and ending the drought? I mean, is it him, or is it sort of what he puts around him in terms of the support staff and the executives and his process?
It's a good, fair question. I mean, in Boston, you know, he came here, and Dan Duquette had assembled a lot of the players that were here, Pedro Martinez, Manny Ramirez, et cetera. Theo put together about half of that team, and they win 2 years later. In Chicago, that really is his team. I mean, there's very little that was already in place. He was allowed to go there and bottom out to basically lose 100 games, wipe things out, start over, draft and develop, build from scratch. So that team is almost 100% his team, and he gets all the credit for what's there. Now, he is a great owner. They spent money, and there was some good fortune there, but it's very rare that you see a blueprint carried out as well as that one was.
We should mention that it was also an Olympic year. Of course, Michael Phelps won 5 medals, adding to his total of 28 overall. And Ryan Lochte, embarrassed himself by fabricating an armed robbery, as we all know. And then there were local medalists like gymnast Ali Raisman, judoka Kayla Harrison, and rower Jevi Stone. In general, American women dominated, something I like to see, winning 27 gold medals compared to 18 for the American men. So I have to ask, what were the Olympic highlights for you? Were you glued to the TV watching the games?
it's a great television event. You were there. You always go, and you bring great coverage to the readers back here. We appreciate that. I only did 3 of them, and they were hard for me to – it's hard to decide where to go when you're over there and there's so many choices.
It's like an all-you-can-eat buffet,
yeah,
and then some.
Yeah, it's tricky. And then television dictates what people are talking about back here, so it's a little frustrating when you're on the ground journalist over there.
I feel you.
Yeah, sitting back here watching TV, I mean, it was great. You know, the stuff – the Phelps thing, it's just off the charts. There's a picture of him on the cover of, I think, Sports Illustrated. He's got all of his medals from all the years. And it looks like, how does he even keep his head up? I mean, it's like so much weight on his chest. So, yeah, that's a great thing. The Lochte thing, you know, it certainly took over here, and people were, you know, paying attention. It was not a good moment for America And I don't think he served anyone well there. Like, I was suspicious of him by the out of the jump. I thought it was
really?
Too much. Yeah, too much, too in front of the camera. He just seemed like an odd guy. And I remember when he was in the pool 4 years ago, I wasn't impressed back then either. So anyway, odd guy, didn't work out well, but we all move on from that. And we celebrate, as you say, the medals that were won, the local people, all the women that won. Great, great story.
So we also had some intersection of sports and culture this year. We had national anthem protests around the country, starting with San Francisco 49er Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the Star Spangled Banner. Many people objected to the mixing of politics and sports, but it certainly caught on with many athletes around the country. Just curious, what did you make of the protests and the criticism that followed it? And do you think we're going to see more of it in 2017?
I mean, the knee-jerk reaction was to, you know, kind of say, you know, we don't like him. Why is he doing that? It's disrespectful. But a lot of people spoke up, you know, some older people, some veterans, you know, people who were involved, oppressed groups. And, you know, I talked to Cedric Maxwell, who played for the Celtics and never came out for the anthem because he said he was fidgety and didn't want to be disrespectful. And but he said, you know, my dad, you know, was a veteran. He served in two wars. And my dad says, you know, he fought for the right for Colin Kaepernick to be able to do that. So I think as Americans, it's okay to stand back and say, okay, you're allowed to do this. I remember the 68 Olympics, Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists. That was not popular at the time. Now there's a statue of them. Some of these things, Muhammad Ali died this year. And, you know, stuff that was unpopular at the time sometimes becomes heroic or enlarged later on. So you do have that. I thought where Kaepernick lost me was not voting and admitting he's not voting. I mean, that didn't play.
Yeah, the actions, you know, your actions have to back up on the field, have to back up what you're doing off the field. Also at Harvard, Amherst, Columbia, and Princeton, teams were punished for making misogynistic and racist comments. For example, around here, the men's soccer team at Harvard produced what they're calling scouting reports that evaluated and rated members of the women's soccer team based on their sexual appeal. First of all, do you think the team's suspension were deserved? And will more attention be paid to the issues of sexism and racism in sports?
Yeah, the more attention you have on these issues, the better it is for everybody. And hopefully the less that there is less bullying, less misogynistic activity. I think that today's vehicles of social media and regular media like we're doing here now, it's just things become larger than they were. And stuff that was okay in the 50s and boys being boys is not okay now. That's a good thing. That's progress that we don't have that. At the same time, I do feel there's an issue that can be a tendency to overreact. And I worry at some of the reaction. It's not breaking news to me when 20-year-old boys behave like nitwits. I mean, it's just that's as old as time. But we don't want to encourage it or say it's okay or have it perpetuated.
Would you put the team suspensions, the ending of the Harvard men's soccer season in the category of overreaction?
Yes.
Or you would?
I would.
You would? Yes. You didn't think you thought Harvard acted too swiftly and too quickly?
It was a lot. I just, again, it was, you can get yourself in trouble with this, so I'll leave it at that. I just thought it was a lot.
And the message sent was, you think, a little more?
Well, it's a strong message, and it certainly hopefully would be discouraging for those in the future.
And now we can turn, you mentioned Muhammad Ali. Let's remember some of those we lost this year. There was Muhammad Ali, as I've said. He died in June after suffering 4 decades with Parkinson's. He was 74. Ali was famously poetic. And this is what he said before losing a match to Joe Frazier in their first fight on March 8th, 1971.
Joe's gonna come out smoking, and I ain't gonna be joking. I'll be pecking and a poking, pouring water on his smoking. Then this might shock and amaze you, but I will destroy Joe Frazier.
How do you think Ali would want to be remembered? I mean, after all, he was a very politically outspoken guy during his career, and he took a certain amount of pride in that.
I certainly have had a feeling he was at peace with himself and the way his life played out. You know, he was a great, came to America as an American champion in 1960 Olympics and had this amazing career, had the issue with the U.S. government, had the Supreme Court rule in his favor. And as years went on, he certainly became one of the most famous persons in the world. I mean, you can go down the line, Nelson Mandela, whatever. He was known everywhere. And I think he had great inner peace. And of course, people felt sorry for him with the Parkinson's and his shaky presence. But I really thought, you know, when you're around him, he had a softness about him, and I think he was really was kind of glowing on the inside about how things worked out for him. It was a life well lived, and a lot of things to be proud of.
We also lost University of Tennessee women's basketball coach Pat Summitt this year. She died 5 years after she was diagnosed with early onset dementia. She was 64. And Summitt was remarkable because she won more games than anyone else in college basketball history, male or female. What's her legacy?
Well, certainly brought a lot of attention to women's sports and, you know, kind of at the forefront of the Title IX movement, and to have, you know, young women with aspirations to go play college sports, to get scholarships, to have the same equality as young men and the same goals. That's a big victory for everybody. And she was, you know, Pat Summitt, very brave at the end, you know, writing a book and you know, putting a face on Alzheimer's and not hiding from it or going away.
That's Dan Shaughnessy, sports columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you for coming in. It was great to see you.
My pleasure, Shira.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston.